Good afternoon, evening. If you guys are like me, having a very informed but yet long day, I realize I'm the last speaker in the last session, so I encourage you to stand up for a minute, if you can. Come on. Because I don't know about you, but sometimes I need to get the blood flowing by this time of the day. Just shake a little bit. I would normally have you clap, but our neighbors next door, I'm sure, won't appreciate that. Just do whatever you can to get the blood flowing. That's right. Get your hands up. I won't do aerobics just yet, but just to, you know, I won't be too long, but do want to be respectful of you guys. I know it's hard to sit, so thank you. So, and I don't have any financial conflicts to disclose. So I'll talk a little bit about the Children's Environmental Health Network, and then I will also, and a little bit about children's health, a little bit, and I will get into the national conversation, and then also use a couple case examples of how we at the network and some of our other partners have been working to implement recommendations found in this action agenda. So the Children's Environmental Health Network has been around for over 21 years now, and we are a national nonprofit. We actually got our start out in California in the late 80s, and our basic mission has been the same, which is to promote safe and healthy environments for all children. We do believe it's a basic right for all children to be able to live and grow and to begin their development in places that don't make them sick, so pretty basic. We support this mission through three main avenues of work, by supporting peer-reviewed science in the field. That's really important to us, and then we use work to translate that science into action by training and education programs. We used to train just healthcare professionals. That's how we got our start out in California, but we recognized soon it wasn't just healthcare professionals, it's everyone that needs to understand some of these connections. And also then the third prong is trying to move towards child protective policy, which is usually the longest, hardest step, but we usually work at the federal government level, but definitely lately have been providing even more technical assistance to states as they've been doing tremendous work at the state level to implement child protective policies for our children. Again, we are the voice for children's environmental health. We were one of the first on the scene, and we're very proud that we're still around. Unfortunately, a nonprofit wants to go out of, sorry, I don't know what that is. Nonprofits want to go out of business. You know, we don't want to have to be around another 21 years, but for now, there's a lot of work to still do. So again, some of the major environmental issues facing children today, there are many challenges that have actually shifted. We used to be more focused on infectious disease. A lot of our attention had to be placed on that. Polio, TB, chronic conditions like obesity and asthma now are taking a lot of our time and attention and the funding within public health. These modern problems cannot be served exclusively by just the medical public health communities. There's a wide range, comprehensive approach, of course, that has to be taken. And I'm sure most of you will know this, but the child's environment plays a huge role in many of the chronic conditions that we are seeing, as well as premature death, lead poisoning, some childhood cancers, and some birth defects, and of course, many long-term adults at onset as well due to early exposures. And again, just some examples of why children are particularly at risk. Many of you were at the Kelver lecture earlier today with Dr. Linda Birnbaum, and she listed out a whole bunch of emerging science that continues to show some of the trends, concerning trends that we've been seeing. But in particular, the Columbia Center for Children's Environmental Health is just one of the many centers conducting this emerging research and this phenomenal research that we then build our work from. They're seeing that PAHs and pesticides and secondhand smoke and what they call PBDEs are all now linked to reduced fetal growth and developmental problems in young children. We also know that prenatal exposures to certain pesticides are reducing birth weight by an average of 6.6 ounces, the equivalent weight reduction seen in babies born to women who smoke. Bisphenol A, just to pick on another one, has many similarities to estrogen, and it may lead to reduced thyroid hormone production in infant boys and their mothers, and UC Berkeley is coming out with some of this research. And also, I just heard from UC Berkeley last week that they're seeing prenatal exposure to BPA being associated with decreased body mass index in girls within a certain age group, and we could go on and on and on. But again, the science is fantastic. It's getting there. I mean, where we were 21 years ago compared to where we are is phenomenal. We still have a lot of groundwork to do within science, but there's more than enough to act on. So now moving to the national conversation. Some of you in the room do know about this. This is an effort, and I will say it was the original brainchild of Dr. Howie Frumkin, who at that time was the National Center for Environmental Health Director at the CDC and the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry. This is going back at least 3.5, maybe 4 years now. the vision for this conversation, this effort, this coalitional effort, I'll call it, was that chemicals are used and managed in ways that are safe and healthy for all people. And I don't think any of us would argue with that fact. And I should also say the premise was never that this already, that there isn't great work going on to help address this vision. It was more of how can we leverage the great work that is going on? How can we identify maybe those areas that maybe aren't going so well and focus more on those areas that are in a collaborative spirit, and especially helping the communities that need the help the most and helping to raise their issues up much, much higher than they have been. So this vision required accurate information. It requires improved scientific understanding, policies and practice, prevention. The whole public health piece, the prevention piece, was corner in this whole effort. Elimination of inequities, improved public health and care engagement, and developing networks and collaboration and coordination. And I will say, I remember when Dr. Frumkin pulled us all together, and I'll say there was maybe 25 of us in a conference room in D.C. one day when he was trying to kind of sell this. And I mean, right then and there, you had folks from the business side of things, you had industry, you had public health, you had nurses and professionals and NGOs and community members. And even then, we were all kind of scratching our heads trying to figure out where this was going. And more importantly, how is this different than maybe some other efforts? And I will say from seeing it now from beginning to end, this was one of the most effective collaborative efforts that I have seen work and not just fall apart, I will say. Now again, this required a change landscape, the recognition that there are many exposure pathways. These were all the ground rules that we all just finally came to an agreement with. Recognition of broad range of health outcomes, biomonitoring needs, large numbers of chemicals that we are constantly exposed to, and how just one singular exposure is one thing, but rarely are we looking at just one. We're looking at mixtures of exposures when we're talking about people's exposures to environmental hazards. That there are now new approaches to toxicity testing. Are we considering them? Are we exploring all that's possible with the technology that we now have? Environmental justice issues, health disparity issues, green chemistry considerations, and the reality that we tend to talk to ourselves a lot. We need to be much better at selling the story, if you will. I'll use the word selling, but we kind of have to sell this to the general public. The core issues of what this whole vision work was addressing certainly don't go against the grain of what any average American would understand, but it's a matter of understanding it, how it applies in one's daily life. Here's just some of the project partners, and I will stress that these are just some. Certainly EPA was engaged. There were many that were engaged in the beginning of this work and what then ended up in a final action plan. And Resolve was actually the fabulous facilitation, and I will say that they really facilitated. There were some hard days. There was a broad participation that was encountered here. There was a leadership council that was set up. The idea that, again, someone has to move this. It's not going to be enough to just say, oh, yeah, we'd like to do this. We have to have someone giving the momentum. So I was one of the co-chairs of the leadership council. And we ended up authoring the action agenda at some point. And again, there were stakeholders and commitments and participants that were representing a wide range of perspectives that were a part of that leadership council as well. Now, there were work groups. It took us a while to figure out how do we best parcel this all out. So there were work groups that then authored reports. Those reports ended up becoming the chapters in what the final action plan actually ended up being. So here are the topics that are listed here, and I'm going to get into each one of them individually. There were over 52 community conversations that were held, webinars, conference calls, town hall meetings, and listening sessions, and that was all a very purposeful, intentful way to involve people that would not be able to come to the open public meetings that were had throughout this two-year process of this development, or maybe couldn't join some of the webinars and the conference calls. So here's just a representation. It's very hard to see, but the squares represent work group members. The circles are community conversations that were held across the country. The triangle are the web dialogue participants. And then the little red dots are state and local forum participants. So an effort was made. There's a lot going on the East Coast I see here. But an effort was made to really encourage and invite people from all over the country to try to get as much of a geographic representation in any part of these conversations along the way. So the desired outcomes here of this action agenda was that you would have an action agenda that was clear and achievable with some clear recommendations. And I will say we started with a much longer document than what is now available on the National Conversation website. There still is a lot there, but it was even longer. And the desired outcomes were to have prevention of harmful exposures. I mean, pretty basic. I mean, that's what we're all striving for, total prevention. scientific understanding of chemicals and their health effects, monitoring of chemical exposures and health outcomes, health and wellness in environmental burden communities, capacity of the public health and healthcare provider workforce, the public's ability to make health protective decisions, so giving them the information they need to empower themselves to then make the best decisions for them for their families, and giving them equal playing ground to do so, and reduction in harm from chemical emergencies. And all of these are infiltrated throughout the chapters of the action agenda. So again, here are all the chapters. So getting into prevention, and prevention is where, for example, protecting children's health resonated, and that's where you'll find that in the action agenda. But the problem here that this chapter was supposed to address is chemical policies in the United States tend not to emphasize the primary prevention. We tend to do very well with retroactively going back and trying to figure out why someone gets sick, but the whole prevention is not taking its priority at times. The elimination or reduction of the causes of health problems. That's what we're trying to aim for here. So there are, again, many recommendations, but the featured recommendations that I'm going to talk to you right now are about the promoting the substitution of hazardous chemicals with the least toxic alternatives, reforming the Toxic Substances Control Act, and Doug Farquhar with the National Center for Environmental State Legislators, was also very integral in our policy chapter, right, and that took that on, and protecting children's health. Those were pretty much the featured recommendations and many subsets of recommendations within those. Also, looking at public health principles and precaution, science of precaution. Precaution was a big discussion among this group. Workers' health, compliance, and also some risk assessment focus areas. The second chapter was on monitoring the public health problem, the ongoing collection, integration, analysis, and interpretation of data about chemical sources, uses, and associated exposures and potential health outcomes is partial, uneven, and minimally integrated. So the recommendations are looking at to improve the quality, the quantity, and the accessibility of comparability health outcome data, expand biomonitoring capacity and use biomonitoring to prioritize public health actions, and to enhance reporting of information on chemical use, source, and use and release. And I will say that the American Public Health Labs were very integral also in this process, and many of you know that they have a huge national biomonitoring program that they've been working on, so many of the folks that were involved in this have been working with them subsequently. Additional recommendations are tracking and surveillance, importance, all kinds of realm of work to be done in there, issues covering local input on data collection, and also biomarkers of effect. The third chapter was on science, understanding that, again, we've come some many ways, but we still lack critical information on health effects of chemicals. As we know, there's anywhere from 85 to, you know, whatever the number is, thousands of chemicals that are in our environment on a regular basis, and the reality is that majority of them are not even tested for their health implications, so that makes it's very unnerving, and we need to do better with that. But understanding we need a process that's realistic to look at those. And specifically those that are much more vulnerable and susceptible in particular, and looking at the benefits and the lessons learned from past exposures and past mistakes, if you will, and looking at the effectiveness of current today interventions to protect public health. So those feature recommendations also looked at identifying, validating, and using novel approaches to evaluate chemical hazards, again, trying to be realistic, developing targeted data to fill gaps in the scientific knowledge of health risks to chemicals, and characterizing human exposures to chemicals across the lifespan, life cycles of human life stages. Also, this chapter gets into coordinating databases. We talked a lot about how there are databases that are not talking to each other but seem very natural to do so, and also the fact that we are not tracking a lot of health information, and what do we do about that? Individual susceptibility, gene and environment interactions, indoor air quality, and Dr. Linda Birnbaum mentioned that. We talk a lot about outdoor, but recognizing indoor air quality needs a great amount of attention since a lot of us spend a lot of time indoors. And also specific science from the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry are all found there. Communities, involvement in communities, again, was a huge cornerstone and huge emphasis for me personally as well as those involved in this effort. The problem, of course, is that many communities and subpopulations are disproportionately impacted and overburdened by harmful chemicals in their communities. So when you look at this chapter, you'll see that there are recommendations to take action to protect communities disproportionately affected by chemical exposures and to broaden the scope specifically of ATSDR's public health action. There's a lot of emphasis on ATSDR since they tend to be the ones on the ground at times that are supposed to be conducting the environmental assessments, and there were a lot of back and forth on the best ways to conduct those assessments and what maybe some lessons learned may be with some challenges that have been found in the past. Additional recommendations look at coordinating federal activities, and obviously I would even say they're, you know, beyond federal activities, there's a lot of coordination opportunity here. Community vulnerability, characteristics, tribal partnerships, and a good amount of talk on training and community engagement and who should be trained and what leaders in the community in particular. Public engagement, this was another chapter. So looking at, despite communication efforts and attention to environmental issues in the media at times, the public is still very unaware of the issues related to chemical exposures and again, how they impact our health, unless it's a specific event like a Katrina or something of that nature. So looking at the recommendations are looking at to develop a multi-directional communication model for government agency use, improving public availability and clarity of chemical information on products through the supply chain, a lot of discussion on labeling and the challenges with that. I mean, very robust, realistic conversations, but ones that need to obviously continue. They're not going to be solved overnight. Develop current and comprehensive environmental and occupational health education, grades K through 16, and certainly beyond that, and graduate level, all kinds of opportunities for building up our next generation of workforce. And also web portals on chemicals and health, public access to data, a lot of discussions on that, and basic trust in the government. I'll be the first to say there have been many, many pitfalls in how some of these communities have been approached in the past, and there's a lot of mistrust and who the messenger is and what the end game is and whether you're making promises that you're keeping. I mean, all of these are just integral outreach, community-based participatory, just basic, genuine building trust and relationship type of activities that need to happen. Healthcare professionals, healthcare providers, and other healthcare professionals are often unprepared to address health concerns related to chemical exposures. And again, I can speak to this personally. When the Children's Environmental Health Network started in the late 80s, again, the original demand came from pediatricians in particular, but certainly nurses dealing with very young patients, nurse practitioners. They were recognizing that they were misdiagnosing. At that time, they were seeing a lot of lead poisoning, a lot of what we now know to be pesticide exposure, mercury exposures, and they just were not prepared, and still are not many prepared in this day and age. Their curriculum is just so vast, they have so much to prepare for. So we then started training exclusively healthcare providers on Children's Environmental Health 101, what to look for in a well child visit, not waiting for a child to get sick. What is an environmental history? How do you ask the certain questions and all of that? So that was then, and it still is true now. There are still a lot of healthcare professionals that are phenomenal and are wonderful and are now teaching in facilities and are doing wonderful things, but we still have a lot of ground still to cover. So these recommendations feature incorporating environmental health and occupational health into health professional education, and it may be at the curriculum level, it may also be at the continuing education level and other graduate level experiences, educating, mentoring, and hiring environmental and occupational health professionals from under-resourced and historically marginalized communities was also a really good, robust piece of this. Looking at public health agency capacities, clinical practice guidelines, professional development, healthcare clinical practice. And the final chapter was on emergencies. And the reality is that our capacity to respond to chemical emergencies is quite limited by inadequate coordination, communication, laws, and the lack of needed data. So some of the feature recommendations look at establishing a set of federal priorities related to chemical emergency planning and preparedness, to develop chemical emergency guidance values that represent risk faced by first responders and the public, and to coordinate, unify, and to integrate federal, tribal, state, and local government efforts related to chemical emergencies. This chapter also talks about having a vision for addressing emergencies. I mean, again, 9/11 changed a lot for us in this country and how we approach things and look at things. Healthcare emergency response, planning tool for local responses, community partnerships, and this emergency support function for responders and planners. So there have been some implementation. A lot of folks have been asking, okay, this is going on 3 years now that the action agenda's been out. Again, 2 years of this, back and forth, and a lot of meetings, and a lot of facilitation, a lot of work group. Then the report was created, and then out of the report came the action agenda. Now what? So this is the phase we've been in, right? And I know a lot of us have been interested, especially me, that's why I'm still connected to this. It's too important. This is an opportunity for us to, again, continue to leverage each other. As we all know, these are very hard economic, resourceful times. This isn't the only time, the first time we've seen this. It doesn't look like there's an end in sight. So we need to, of course, continue to do this important work and be very creative about how we're doing it. And one of the best things is to work together and to leverage each other the best we can. So I do know that this national conversation has been working to assess progress. We do have, it's not a leadership council anymore, it's a different name, but it's like a little leadership group that I'm still the co-chair of, along with Henry Anderson out of Wisconsin Public Health Department. And again, folks like Doug and Megan Latshaw with the American Public Health Labs and some others join us on conference calls every month or two. And there are designated people that were a part of the original process that have volunteered themselves to be the lead on all of those chapters. So there's someone representing all those chapters. And they're trying their best to be the eyes and ears and the filter, you know, what they're hearing that makes sense, that people are working on and groups are working on that fulfills some of the requirements and recommendations in the action agenda. We want to translate that. We want people to know about that. And also, we've been doing surveys to get them out to the key actors. There are specific agencies and organizations that are identified in these recommendations. Many federal agencies, many businesses, many academic programs, and on. There's a role for everybody, including the individual. But for those agencies that are mentioned a lot, we want to assess, where are they? Have they looked at the action plan? Are they implementing strategies that are specific to their code of work of the action plan? What can we share that you're doing? We want to share. We want to be transparent with the public that deserves to know this. And the bigger challenge, what are the challenges you're having with implementing some of the action plan? How might we all work together to help you? So these dialogues continue. It was a little frustrating at first because it was kind of very quiet, but we're continuing to move forward. I happen to be based in D.C., so I'm very committed to actually sitting down with a lot of the lead of these agencies along with some of our other colleagues, like folks at the APHA and beyond. We also have a working group here in the environment section of APHA that also is very interested in teasing out specific elements of work of this action plan. Like I mentioned, the American Public Health Laboratories has a biomonitoring effort that they are poised and wonderful to work on, so it's very natural that those in our section that are interested in that are now working with them. And then there are, again, all kinds of actions that were happening even before this effort that continue to happen that we're trying to track and monitor much more effectively. For example, I do know that ATSDR and the National Center for Environmental Health, these are some of the specific recommendations that they've been starting to work on or have already been in the process of working on. And they specifically created geographic branches to ensure that all work in a particular area is coordinated. That came right out of the recommendations of this effort. There was a lot of discussion about how ATSDR is organized and how more troops, if you will, on the ground is needed. So they actually adhered that advice and they started moving some staff from the headquarters to some of the regional centers. And they were also hiring additional staff in the regions at this time last year. They also convened a science symposium, and that was a specific recommendation, again, specifically out of the community chapter. And they are examining options to expand the reach of the National Center for Environmental Health biomonitoring efforts. But again, I will say that, as you all probably know, CDC's budget is going through some hard times along with a lot of our friends in the federal government. So we all recognize that some of these recommendations do require additional funding. That's the bottom line. But many of them do not. It might take re-coordination. It might take reducing other aspects that maybe aren't as fruitful right now and focusing attention in other ways. Some of our work, the Children's Environmental Health Network, specifically, again, our work is covered under the prevention chapter, which specifically talks about protecting children from harmful chemicals. So I do want you to know about our Eco-Healthy Child Care Program. It's the only program in the country that's working to train and educate child care professionals on what we call Children's Environmental Health 101, why children are vulnerable, what are some loaded, no-cost steps that are science-based, peer-reviewed, that we recommend that you can take to provide healthier and safer environments in child care. No one else was really doing that when we started doing this in 2004. And we also have a two-year endorsement side for the program. So there's a 30-item checklist. Again, it took 2 years to get it all peer-reviewed, and what are the right questions to ask? The questions all pertain to specific policies that are going on in those centers. These are all licensed centers because we have to be able to follow them and track them in a standardized way. But they fulfill at least 24 out of the 30 questions. You can find this checklist on our website, or we mail them out as needed, or we bring them to all kinds of conferences and trainings. And if you meet the minimum of the 24, there are three that are non-negotiable. One is around lead. For example, if you have a facility built before the 70s and you don't test for lead, that's a no deal. They have to start testing for lead and show proof of that before they can get approved. You get the two-year endorsement if you pass. You get marketing material, posters, decals. You get put up on our website, so parents that are looking for childcare and are adding this type of criteria to their long laundry list of childcare that they're looking for can go and look in Tacoma Park, Maryland, and see who's endorsed in their area that might be of interest to them. Then every 2 years, they have to renew. They also agree, and I should say that they have to have a couple signatures on this. They have to have a non-staff signing to verify that what the director or facility manager is reporting is accurate. They also agreed to a 48-hour pop-up visit, environmental assessment by one of our staff, which means we can't get to everybody. We used to do that when we did a pilot in D.C. We went to every child care facility in D.C. that we were working with. That's not realistic when we're talking about child care all over the country. And we are getting inquiries from other parts of the world. But anyway, when we are in a state for conferences or trainings or whatever, we will take a random pick of some of our endorsed centers and go visit and make sure that what they're reporting are accurate. And thankfully, so far, we haven't found any inaccuracies. You can understand these are all voluntary programs. This is going above and beyond what the basic child care standards are asking for at this point. Obviously, we're also trying to work with child care licensing, which happens at the state level. Every state is much different. Ideally, a few years from now, we won't have to work so hard because some basic environmental practices will already be incorporated into child care licensing. We won't have to beg for lead tests to be happening in older buildings built before the 70s. We won't have to beg for them to not just have any random pesticide company come in to spray, and they don't know what's being sprayed, and then they're in the next day, so the whole window of gap that they're supposed to be avoiding is not being adhered to, and on and on. We've seen a lot of things. So that program is going, and that's where that website is where you can find more information on that. We also have a Health in All Policies program, and this is supported by the CDC, and this is looking at taking into consideration the vulnerabilities of children at the beginning of the policymaking process instead of traditionally at the end. So any city or any county or any program that has influence within a locality that's trying to implement some new policy, to have them start asking these very key questions. And we have all kinds of documents on in a tool guide that can assist communities that are trying to think, again, very proactively along a Health in All Policies route. And we do have a new pediatric training resource geared ideally towards healthcare professionals and clinical faculty, but it's been used in the past by a wide range of community members, and it's going to be out probably by next month. Our previous version was just a desktop reference. This one's going to be online. It's going to be in individual chapters, PowerPoint modules, which is what we heard from healthcare professionals. That's the mode that they would prefer, and they're already going to be put together so people can take all of it or a chapter, a topical chapter, and they can use it for their own professional presentations or their own teaching or any other way that they might want among their colleagues and friends. So those are some ways that we're helping to address some of the very key specific areas in the prevention chapter of the national conversation. Here's the website. We encourage all of you who would like to get involved to get involved. Again, it's not easy. This is a huge effort, but it's not dead. it continues. There's a lot of, tracking work to do. But what's nice is we're not starting at the very beginning. Again, a lot of this work has been going, but it's just a matter of coordinating. It's a huge opportunity to network and build relationships and partner, and that's one of many benefits to this effort. And here are my three not-so-little ones anymore, but just three of millions of reasons that I'm very passionate about all of this work. So thank you for your time.
Any questions for Ensei? Yes.
The implementation is a real
duty. Yep. Yep. Ooh. It's a good concept. Now, we definitely, that's really something, and I should have mentioned that thanks to the help of some wonderful grad assistants this year, because we found out we needed some worker bees. And again, this is all voluntary, but we did get some interns this year. One of mine came from Michigan State, who's leaving at the end of the month, and I know CDC has one or two now. They've been helping us with these surveys and the development of that. The plan is now to ideally release a report annually. And a grading scale or whatever it is, I mean, we don't want to, you know, make folks feel bad, but we do want to add a little bit of pressure here. And again, more bottom line is accountability. Your mention as an actor, because we see this as your role, or you present yourself with this role, you know, here's your opportunity to respond or set us straight, or at least, you know, here's an opportunity to translate what you're doing or at least express what you're doing to the public. So I'm hoping that a lot of these actors do take us up on this, but there will be annual reports, as we're hoping to at least let the general public know where we stand and the efforts that are being made and who's responded, who hasn't. So hopefully that will help also motivate some others to get moving. Thank you for that. Any other questions? Hi.
I have a question. You talked a bit about in the action agenda under the prevention and policy section, reforming the practice of control action.
Yep.
I wonder if you could talk a bit more about that.
About the act itself?
About
the reform?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, Doug, you want to jump in? No news, right? Yeah, that's true. I mean, there's not much to report at the federal level, unfortunately. My organization, among many, has just been waiting for a little sliver of opportunity. The bottom line is that our current toxic reform inventory law, TSCA, is pretty broken. It hasn't worked for a long time. Everyone's vocal about that. The EPA administrators, Jackson and now McCarthy, are very vocal about that. It's not an easy transition, but it's going to take some political leadership. We had some political leadership in Senator Lautenberg, and unfortunately he passed away. So there's been some, you know, that was unfortunate, and many of us thought that there was going to be, if not something passing, certainly some good discussions that then lead hopefully to some future successes. But states are moving on this, and that is exciting. But at the federal level, it's pretty mute right now, and we'll see. As you know, this Congress has been tough to work with on many levels. So, yes.
What is there that's been happening with states in the most prominent?
This is right. Thank you.
So that's what we're talking about. They're coming up with these laws which kind of gum up the process of normal lobbying in D.C. And because the industry has a system where they know who to talk to and how to take things off and who to work with in D.C., but they don't have that system.
Yeah. Yep. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you to all three of our speakers. We do have a few more minutes, just a few actually, I think about five or seven. So I wanted to see if anyone had a question that they wanted to address to all three speakers. I actually have one, if folks are willing to stay around for another couple of minutes. I'm curious, in all of your experiences with involving stakeholders and community groups and the community conversations as part of the national conversation, what do you see as the biggest challenge to involving a wide and diverse group of stakeholders?